family for coming tonight. Wonderful talk. We're hoping to get a dialogue from you. We know that everybody in this audience has different views on the speech that you just heard. It's exactly as it should be at Open University, committed to free speech. Thank you for coming. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
And now it's time for question and answers. So try to keep your questions and comments to a minute, minute and a half.
Girls in Texas, and they were white, and you know, were named Lindsay and Sarah or whatever. That the situation would have received a lot more publicity. And the reason for that is like the media doesn't cover it as much, and people are afraid to talk about it so much because they're afraid of offending people. And you know, for some reason, whatever, in today's society, people are more afraid of offending. Should I say minorities or non-Christians, and obviously that's not right. And I mean, obviously based on your reasoning, it's pretty clear that Islam preaches violence against women and non-Muslims, and it needs some major reforms. So what do you think, and what do you think it will take, and what do you think it will happen, that Americans will be able to freely speak about the need for reform to happen within Islam, so that situations like what happened in Fort Hood earlier this year, where political correctness got lots of people killed, and it'll continue to happen. What do you think it'll take that people can come out in the open and talk about this issue so we can deal with it peacefully before it really escalates and before a lot more people die as a result?
I think we ought to do a number of things, and the first step is to emancipate ourselves from the idea and from the inhibition that we can't criticize all the ideas and all the religions and all the beliefs in the world except Islam. That takes emancipation. When you look at the political correctness surrounding discussing the principles of Islam, you start to wonder why Islam. If I were a Christian, I'd be offended. I'm an atheist. I don't enjoy the same protection. So one step is, let's take Islam for what it is. It's a set of beliefs. And let's examine. There are good things in there. There are things that are not so good, but not so harmful. And there are terrible things in there. All sorts of beliefs have that. Now, I understand the objection by many Muslims to say there are people who will use the criticism of Islam as an idea, as an excuse to hurt Muslim individuals, to discriminate against them, to abuse their rights or to violate their rights. And that's where the second step comes in. We have to protect the rights and freedoms of all individuals who live here, whether they are Muslim or not. By doing that, by protecting the Muslim individual, then we also take away from him the argument that Islam will only and can only be reformed and Islamic tenets can be addressed only after we've given a guarantee that all people are protected. I would rather give the priority to victims like Amina and Sarah. Then the third step would be to protect the rights of people who think out aloud. I met a young man here tonight, and I get emails from Muslim individuals who say, I relate to you, I don't agree with everything you say, but there's so many things that I agree with, and I want to come out and say these things, and I want to come out and publish them, and I can't, because I don't want to live like you, I don't want to be threatened, and I don't want to run the risk of being killed. That sentiment, and it's growing, should make you all worried, because that is hollowing out the roots of the rule of law. If a society cannot protect its citizens, if a society cannot protect the freedom of expression, then that society is going to collapse. Then it's going to be like all the other societies where Muslim immigrants are running away from. So I would say start to treat Islam as a basic, basically as any other idea, and protect the freedom of expression as we protect all, in order to safeguard the public arena where we can have a debate. And finally, and that's what my statement was, my lecture was about tonight, women's rights, the emancipation of a Muslim woman is the key to reforming Islam. Jihad or, the reason, applying reason to Islam. I think that's a great concept. And I have a dear friend and colleague who's engaged in that, who did not leave Islam, who considers herself a Muslim. Her name is Irshad Manji. And she has Project Ijtihad, where she's saying, okay, for us, we should start the reform from the inside. But just like me, she walks around with bodyguards. She's protected, she's not safe. So even the benign criticism from within, even those who do not want to leave the faith, are confronted with violence. And not just that, they are not protected by the large group of Muslims who should be able to say, well, I don't care whether you're doing it in the name of Allah or in the name of Quran. Don't use my religion to commit violence. What we see increasingly is an excited, maybe even over-excited group of Muslims who want to protect the image of Islam. Some of them will want to take to the streets, burn embassies, burn flags, when, according to their perception, the icons of Islam, like the cartoons of Muhammad, when that sort of thing happens, then they will organize themselves and go to the streets. They will not organize themselves when people are killed in the name of Muhammad, when verses are read out loudly from the Quran and people are killed, men kill their wives or their daughters or beat them up. And I think that's what I mean. When I say let's engage Muslims, that's what I mean. Let's engage in that. Let's talk about verse 4, chapter 4, verse 34 of the Quran. Let's talk about chapter 2, verse 222 of the Quran. Let's see how that's implemented. Stop running away from it. Come on. And stop distracting, stop changing the subject, and stop telling me over and over again Islam means peace. When in the name of Islam, almost all, if you look at two-thirds of all violence in the world is committed by Muslims against other Muslims or against non-Muslims in the name of Islam. And Muslims make up only one-fifth of the world population. Then you can't go on claiming that Islam is peace, please. I'm sorry, that's not an opinion, that's a fact. That's how we should engage and talk to Muslims.
Hi, this is Hi, my name is Asifa Qureshi. I'm a faculty member at the law school here, University of Wisconsin. So welcome as a faculty member to Wisconsin. I teach constitutional law and Islamic law, and it's actually with both of those hats that I welcome you here and that you're offering alternative ideas. It's my First Amendment support as a professor of constitutional law. It's also my affinity with the spirit of Ihtilaf and diversity in Islamic legal history that with both of those hats, I welcome any alternative ideas for us to discuss. But it's with my constitutional law hat that I've been listening to you tonight, actually, interestingly enough. And your point about Islam being incompatible with liberal democracy, I've heard that many times. Interestingly enough, I've actually heard that more from Muslims, conservative Muslims, than I have from people like you. In fact, I remember conversations just as a grad student at Harvard doing my PhD where I debate this with people. But now I'm a professor of constitutional law where I teach 14th Amendment and separation of powers and all this. And I couldn't help but sort of replay what you're saying about Islam with my comparative perspective. And it occurred to me that if I were to describe American constitutional law with three bullet points, for example, as you were reading bullet points out of Islam, and I said, American constitutional law says that a birth father of a child does not have the right to see his child if he's not married to the mother. and that those women who have their health threatened as a result of an abortion do not have the right, if their health is threatened, they still do not have the right to an abortion, and that it is unconstitutional for school districts to try to correct past racism as a result of civil rights discrimination in our history. If I were to say all of those things represent American constitutional law, I would actually be referencing actual cases, current law on the books, that I just taught last semester in my 14th Amendment constitutional law class. Now, if you think that's an accurate description in the audience here, if you think that's an accurate description of constitutional law, then I commend you for a really nice, concise description of Islamic law. But if you all think that that's not really quite the whole picture, then I advise all of us to take a pause and think that maybe there's a little bit more to this story than we've heard tonight, and we've only just heard one slice, and I encourage you all to continue to learn about that, just like you would take a constitutional law class if you want to know more about the Constitution. Thank you very much.
On abortion, the rights of gay people to marry, euthanasia, and healthcare. You know what I see? When the American Constitution is enacted, I see people whose opinions are sharply different, oppose one another and debate with one another. And except for one crazy man, two crazy people on the abortion side, there are no threats that I know of. And if there are threats, those people who are threatened are protected by American law. What I also see is that those who resort to violence are compelled and expelled by their own groups, whether they're on the left or on the right. Now let's take a country that implements Islam in the Quran, and Islam as its constitution, and Islamic law or Sharia, Saudi Arabia. Do you think, in all honesty, that you could have a debate, an honest debate as we have in the United States, on gay marriages, abortion, women's rights in Saudi Arabia, and get away with it? The most successful ethnic cleansing of all time has taken place in the one place in the world where Sharia is implemented, and that's the ethnic cleansing of Jews, take a place or another place where Sharia is implemented, Iran. The president comes and proudly tells us that there are no gay people, where women are forced to veil themselves. It is in the Quran that a man should have sex with his wife, whether she likes it or not. In the United States, that's marital rape. In Saudi Arabia, in Iran, everywhere in the world where Sharia is implemented, that's legal. It's true, there's another side to this story. Do these constitutions differ or not? I'm not making it up, it's an empirical reality. Differences so that Muslims living in the United States could appreciate American Constitution and maybe as enlightened individuals share these values with their fellow Muslims, whether it's in America or outside of America.
In the interest of time and judging by the amount of questions that we have, we're going to try and keep our answers very brief, and while we certainly appreciate your comment, Ms. Ali, if you could also keep it brief, that would be great. Thank you.
Yeah, I just got mad at
that. Yes. In the interest of time, thank you.
Ms. Ali, I am a citizen of an Islamic country. I'm very grateful to hear you say that a country that practices Islam as its constitution or its main focus is going to collapse soon, or might collapse. And I am
resounding with this when I hear back home that places of worship are being threatened and attacked. So as a law-abiding citizen, what advice would you give to me? Because as a non-Muslim, I am not well accepted to engage in open debate. I might be threatened. So what do you think about this?
If you have time to blog, and you can do that anonymously, you could set up lots and lots of blogs talking about the country where you come from, what is going on, and invite Muslims to come and debate with you. The problem is, right now, it's only radical Muslims who are setting up study centers and madrasas and blogs, etc., etc. We're not meeting that kind of activism. And I think we need counter-activism and the new technology. The age of information that we live in gives us the opportunity to confront them without having to sacrifice our lives.
Thing is, right now... Thank you.
Right now, as if it's going to go on a whole other
retreat. You mentioned that Islam has not seen a large change since it was first created as a religion. And into the secularization, the church and state separation that we at least saw in Christianity. Now, the way we got that in Christianity was a lot of religious wars, 30 years war, a long series of conflicts that eventually led people to realize that it wasn't that religious war was fighting over. Now, in countries like Iraq recently, we've seen increasingly secular governments, increasingly secular parties take over religious parties due to constant secular conflicts, which eventually got Iraqis into a similar state of mind. Now, what do you think of the concept of war and violence and those effects on secularization in society?
Well, the only way to curb violence in society is by applying the rule of law, and many Muslim countries either have despots or corrupt governments, and the opposition, the largest oppositions in Muslim countries, wants to bring about states that are based on Sharia law. Now, that promises also more violence. So the answer is, I mean, you say it took Christians many years and a lot of bloodshed. We have had in Islam a lot of bloodshed, and Islam exists for 1400 years, and I think this is the 21st century is the opportunity to have Muslim minds and Muslim individuals be confronted with alternative ideas that are successful. See, that's what I want to underscore. It's no longer a theory that political freedom and economic freedom is better than divine law. It is practice. We see it in almost all countries. It's not perfect, but it's better than where Sharia law is implemented. And I hope that Muslims can benefit from that and can learn from that. I hope that institutions like this one will educate young Muslim minds as future leaders to distinguish good ideas from bad ideas, even if those ideas were given in the best of them.
Mr. Salby, thank you for speaking. I'm Jason from Political Science here. You said something fascinating earlier in your speech. You spoke about how when you were in Germany deciding whether to go to Canada or flee to the Netherlands, that there was sort of a good and a bad voice or angel on your shoulder. And you said the voice of sin won. That really struck me because I'm a confessing Christian who really believes in the power of sin. And I'm curious about your own beliefs because you're such a cogent and forceful speaker for moral law, which I tremendously commend you for. And I'm curious, would you say now that I'm an atheist, I rejected the idea of sin? Or would you say that the moral law is still connected to right religious conduct in a certain way? Thank you.
Thank you for your question. The way I get this question many times, the way I answer it is there are people who believe that God created man, and there are people who believe that man created God. And I have no doubt that the God you believe in and the concept of God that you adhere to is probably wonderful. And I will continue to believe that until, in the name of your God, you start to argue that other people's freedoms can be infringed upon or impose your beliefs on them. Personally, it works for me that God created man, and having emancipated myself from him or her or it, just so shocking. I'm not keen to go back into the ideas of sin, because that is too absolute. I want to know, when something is wrong, what is wrong with it? Why is it wrong? What is the context, etc.? And the emancipation from religion has given me the opportunity, without fear of a hereafter, without fear from co-religionists, to ask these questions, to seek answers, and that's the idea that I defend.
I would just like to get a very quick gauge. We have very long lines on either side. We tried to gender diversify those lines in the name of equality here. Given the answers of roughly 1 to 2 minutes, how many more questions do you feel comfortable taking tonight, Ms. Hirsielli?
That's putting me on the spot. We started an hour later, and I'll take 3 from here and 3 from there.
Okay, so 6 more questions.
Yeah.
Okay.
Please keep them short.
Hi, my name is Mohammed.
I want to ask.
Oh, okay. And I'm a fellow company. I'm from the San Antonio. And all the things that you say, I don't agree with you. But I disagree with you. That doesn't mean I threaten you or I say something bad to you. Earlier you say that Islam is a lion and everything. And I was born to Mother Islam. And my father was Muslim, to my state rights, to live in this country for 11 years, my paper, my titles. My question to you, okay, how do people believe you that when you lie, when you were in a Dutch country, your immigration status, and they kick you out of the country, and how will all these people believe you what you say is true? Were you telling that truth, or were you telling the truth right now? What, when would you lie? And my second point to you is, you said Muhammad was a brother of violence. His own uncle was a Muslim, and he wasn't violent. He didn't kill his own people that surrounded him was a Jewish. And my question to you, why would you all point everything that violent in Muslim. And people that World War II was a Muslim, Pearl Harbor was a Muslim, you know, Normandy was a Muslim. And all those things that happened, the people did it. Christianity, Catholic, Orthodox, everybody killed each other. And let me point to you, there's a verse in the Quran saying, وَمَنْ أَحْيَى النَّاسَ فَكَأَنَّمَا أَحْيَى النَّاسَ جَمِيعًا وَمَنْ قَتَلَ النَّاسَ فَكَأَنَّمَا قَتَلَ النَّاسَ. When you kill somebody, like you kill entire people, and when you save somebody, like you save entire people. So I'm telling all these arguments, the Quran, it's not violent teaching. I memorized the Quran when I was kids. So my question to you, my question to you, like, how would I believe you right now, or would I believe you when you were lying in immigration status? So,
when I came to the Netherlands and I asked for asylum, I laughed. I pretended I came from Somalia. I didn't tell them about the fact that I was escaping an arranged / forced marriage. That's well known. But I'm not here to dispute that. And in answer to the first question, the first thing that comes to my mind, let's assume that I am a liar, that I'm an evil person. Let's assume that I'm traumatized and that I need a scapegoat for all the terrible things I experienced or didn't experience in my life. Still, Muslims will have to contend with the fact that 2/3 of all violence in the world are committed by Muslims against Muslims or Muslims against non-Muslims. We have to contend with the reality that one of the two countries where Islamic law is implemented is developing a nuclear bomb ready to use, and that we are facing a global crisis of peace and war. Let's, as those of us born into Muslim, face the fact that thieves in any place, people who are suspected of being thieves, hands are amputated, as is done by the Shabab in Somalia, parts of Nigeria, Afghanistan, parts of Iraq. Let's contend with the concept of martyrdom or suicide killings. Let's contend with the current anti-Semitic trend that is now spread in the name of Islam. Even if I were the most evil person in the world, even if I didn't exist, these realities exist, and Muslims have to face them. Your second question, which is tied to the first question, the people who commit these atrocities cite the Prophet Muhammad. When I talked to men who wanted to bring down the age of marriage from 18 in the Netherlands to 15, and I told them you can't do that, in this country this is considered to be against the law, they argued, but it's the Prophet Muhammad who took a 9-year-old to be his wife. If you look at a country like Iran, or like Saudi Arabia, or Yemen, or any of the places where Sharia as family law is implemented, there is an epidemic of child rights. And in fact, taking child rights is still today justified in the name of Muhammad. Jihad, Muhammad is the example. He's the one who conquered Medina, he conquered Persia, he conquered and conquered and conquered and expanded Islam. And those who followed him after his death did the same. And they did it because Muhammad gave the example. And so it is the fact that you have an icon who, on the one hand, cannot be judged, cannot be questioned, and on the other hand, justified all these violations of human rights. And I want you to look at what Muhammad said and examine him, not my mental state and whether I lie or not, because that really doesn't make a difference.
In your book, The Caged Virgin, you talk about how the enforcement of virginity is used as a tool to oppress women in Muslim communities around the world, in Africa and the Netherlands, which you talk about specifically. And I was wondering if you could talk about sexual freedom as an important part of women's rights.
The student wants to know if I could talk about sexual freedom as a basic right, and I wanted to say I completely agree with the fact that not sexual freedom, not only sexual freedom for women, but sexual freedom for all humans is a basic right, and it's denied more to women than it is denied to men, but it's also denied to men in the name of Islam.
First, I want to say thank you for coming here, because all my life as a Muslim woman, I have struggled with the same thing that you have. And because I have disagreed with some of these beliefs, I have also been looked down upon as an infidel. But you talk about the U.S. providing religious freedoms, and I just want to let you know that not too long ago, there was a Jewish man who was on a plane, and he wanted to pray before the plane took off, and the airplane hostess did not recognize his ritual and thought he was a terrorist and took him off the plane. And I don't consider that to be religious freedom in the U.S. I have two short questions, though. Although I agree, I have also struggled with changing the stereotypes of Islam and Muslim men and women in the U.S. because there is a profound amount of ignorance that's going on, especially because of the terrorism that's occurring. But I also want to know that in a time where Islam is repudiated, do you think that speaking out so adamantly against it is wise?
Thank you for your question. I think, again, that we have to make a distinction between Islam and Muslims. Muslim individuals, like you've all shown tonight, you come from different places and you either practice the religion, used to practice the religion, don't practice it anymore, or try or aspire to practice it as purely as you possibly can. So Muslims are diverse. Islamic doctrine has a complete, comprehensive set of beliefs. That's what I'm after. Because people, see, look, ideas and beliefs, when they are valued, people practice them, but not only that, they pass them on to their children, they pass them on to their community, the idea spreads. And when you have a large enough group of people practicing a bad or trying to practice a bad idea, the consequences can be terrible, as we know from Allah. I'm not stating that only Islam or Islamic beliefs are bad ideas. Humanity is full of it. Islam is the only set of beliefs in the West that is exempted from the same scrutiny that we give to our ideas. So my whole point tonight is, let's embark on that. Let's scrutinize. Why can we talk about Karl Marx and reading and list down the good things that he said and the terrible consequences of his idea and refrain from mentioning Muhammad? Well, there are 1.57 billion people who say they follow Muhammad's creed. I would say that's an urgent, you know, an important task to embark on, to examine Muhammad's ideas. If people keep saying that, then I want to know, what is it about? And the Quran is not a big book. The Hadith, the volumes are not that big. They're easy, they're accessible, and these days they're in English and other languages. So you can't debate with Muslims the idea that only came from, you know, you needed cultural anthropologists and cultural attachés in the State Department to explain and interpret Islam to you is no longer the case. You know, you can now talk to fellow Muslims because they're Muslims living here. You can go to Muslim countries and you can read Islam description and have a proper debate, you know, with Muslims about Islam.
Your braveness has been also spoken about the critics and everybody is strong. And if your goal was to make a strong feeling in the audience that against Islam, a Muslim, and a Muslim think he'd be ashamed of his religion, you have been very successful, I believe. That's along with the media, Western media. But if you wanted to give a good picture of Islam, and what you said was mostly applied to a portion of this, you know, it kind of one sort of interpretation of Islam, which is more fundamental. Going back to the country that you talked a lot about, the example of state and Sharia, but when religion gets to the power, you know, it's only a tool. It's not a good way to look at, to know Sharia when it is in power and wants to keep the power with any means. But and going back to Iran, as you mentioned, there are many reformists there, and Islamic reformists and imams, that I invite you to read about them to have a different picture of that. And I invite you to read the books of Dr. Seroush, because a well-known philosopher, the late Ayatollah Montazeri and the other Ayatollahs there were reformists because of being having a different picture and equality between the men and women. They have been under great pressure from the state religion. But another kind of story that, unless you mention that, I won't call your picture unbiased.
The question is, there are so many people, for instance in Iran, theologians who are looking for new interpretations and who see a hope in reforming Islam. I've read Seroush, I've read Abu Zayd, and the idea that they want to promote, and it's not only them, there are many people who are doing that, that Islam was misinterpreted. I find it noble, and I think it's a good exercise, but I don't find it convincing. And I don't find it convincing because, you know, if I write a paper or an article and I'm doing it in my fourth language, and I'm misunderstood and misinterpreted by one or two people, I can shrug my shoulders over that. But if I'm misunderstood by millions of people, and you are God, and you're omniscient and powerful, then I start to wonder, maybe God, Allah, the Quran is not misunderstood. And when I read the Quran and the Hadith, I find them to be explicit. And I think that the next step for in the process of reforming Islam is to emancipate oneself from the idea that reformation can only be found in Islamic scripture. I think that the Muslim mind can be opened also, probably more importantly, by looking outside of Islam and then retaining of Islam those things that people still consider to be valuable, like hospitality, generosity, and maybe spiritual meaning, like Sufism. But the political and social dimensions of Islam are better discarded. I don't think gazing at the Quran for hours and hours and hours is going to help that.